Day 403, Wednesday, May 8th. Ecclesiastes 2. Ecclesiastes 2 1-26 NKJV. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure, but surely, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. I made my works great, I built myself houses, and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants, and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. Then I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceived that the same event happens to them all. So I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me, and why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this also is vanity. For there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever, since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die? As the fool. Therefore I hated life because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind. Then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. Yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled and in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. Therefore I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor in which I had toiled under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. For what has man for all his labor, and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful, and his work burdensome. Even in the night his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity. Nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also, I saw, was from the hand of God. For who can eat, or who can have enjoyment, more than I? For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight, but to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him who is good before God. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Daily Deep Dive, the UCG reading plan states, in the King's Investigation of Madness and Folly, Ecclesiastes 1:17, he plunges into the pursuit of mirth and pleasure, which he labels madness and folly, Ecclesiastes 2:1-3. Life at Solomon's court was an ongoing party. Dr. Walter Kaiser comments, With what hilarity and laughter must the palace halls have echoed as Solomon, his courtiers, and his guests exchanged jokes, drank wine, listened to the witty merrymakers from all over the region, and feasted bountifully each day on 30 measures of fine flour, 60 measures of meal, 10 fat oxen, 20 oxen from the pastures, 100 sheep, in addition to harts, roebucks, fallow deer and fattened fowl, 1 Kings 4:22-23. Some estimates suggest that it would take 30 or 40,000 people to consume that much food each day. No wonder 1 Kings 4:20 says, Judah and Israel were as many as the sand which is by the sea in multitude, eating and drinking, and making merry. The whole plan was to sample mirth, pleasure, wine and folly until he could determine what was good for the sons of man. Ecclesiastes, Total Life, pages 55-56. Solomon sought sensual gratification while, he says, guiding my heart with wisdom. This is surprising, for the extent of the king's hedonistic exercise seems to have been rather foolish. Indeed, we know from other scriptural reports about him that he overindulged in more than food and wine. How does he maintain that there was any wisdom guiding his heart? What seems to be implied is that Solomon never wholly abandoned himself to mindless dissipation. Rather, as he experimented with various pleasures, he was always thinking them over, considering their worth in making life better and in fulfilling man's longings. Again, we should realize that the wisdom Solomon speaks of here is not ultimate godly wisdom, but rather the height of human reason employed in examining life's opportunities. Solomon came to recognize that living for the sake of pleasure is pointless. It involves a degree of madness in trying to escape the real world with its problems, for after one has his period of fun, the problems are still there. And depending on one's choice of amusements, his own problems could be magnified. Consider, however, that at the conclusion of this section in Ecclesiastes 2:24-26, Solomon will advocate finding enjoyment in life. Yet, as he will make clear, especially in the book's overall conclusion, this comes in the context of a right relationship with God, experiencing his blessings within proper boundaries as part of a life committed to him. We will never find fulfillment in pursuing enjoyment for its own sake. True joy and happiness is the byproduct of a life properly devoted to God. Solomon next moves on to material pursuits, accomplishments and amassing wealth and luxuries, Ecclesiastes 2:4-11. He says the great building projects and acquisitions here were for himself, using the word myself 6 times in this section, verses 4-8. So this was just a different way of pursuing personal pleasure, verse 10. In verse 8, the New King James Version has the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds, this particular and being interpolated, as it's not present in the actual Hebrew. This translation, close to the earlier King James rendering, follows a traditional Jewish interpretation, but the Hebrew words rendered musical instruments, shittah weshittoth, used nowhere else in the Old Testament, are actually a matter of dispute. The ESV Archaeology Study Bible notes on verse 8 that the Greek tradition, the Septuagint, Aquila, and Theodotion, all translate the underlying Hebrew word with terms suggesting something to do with drinking cups and or cupbearers. Yet the same study Bible also explains the ESV translation of concubines, just as other versions translate the phrase as concubine and concubines. Green's literal translation, a wife and very many wives, NKJV, or a harem, NIV. Expositor says of shittah and its plural form shittoth, a Canaanite word of similar form is used to translate the Egyptian word for concubine in a letter of, Pharaoh, Amenophis 3, footnote on verse 8. And Shitta may be derived from the Hebrew root shad, meaning breast. Those who see Solomon's harem in mind here leave out the interpolated and, taking the concubines to be among the delights of the sons of men. A few other translations have been proposed, but in any case we know from 1 Kings 11:3 that a vast number of women, 700 wives and 300 concubines, were certainly included in Solomon's statement in Ecclesiastes 2:10. Whatever my eyes desired I did not keep from them. I did not withhold from my heart any pleasure. Solomon's statement in verse 9 that his wisdom remained with him does not mean he was acting wisely. It could mean that he always retained wisdom in his head despite what he did. That is, he always knew better. Or the statement may have the same sense as that about guiding his heart with wisdom in verse 3, referring to him always evaluating his worldly pursuits and gains, considering whether or not they brought fulfillment. As he acknowledges in verse 11, they did not, being vanity and grasping for the wind and not containing the profit or benefit sought at the outset of the book, Ecclesiastes 1:3. All that money can afford does not buy happiness. Solomon's mention in Ecclesiastes 2:9 of being the greatest and wealthiest is important in this regard. As David Moore writes in the Holman Old Testament commentary, if the most powerful and wealthy man in the world could not find happiness in possessions apart from God, then the futility of pursuing such things becomes evident for the rest of us. This lesson is similar to what Solomon learned about being the wisest man in the world, Ecclesiastes 1:12-13, Ecclesiastes 1:18, Ecclesiastes, Song of Songs, Max Anders, ed., note on Ecclesiastes 2:9. In many ways, people in affluent societies today live in better conditions than Solomon did. And in the midst of rampant godlessness, the Apostle Paul prophesied of this time when people would be lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, 2 Timothy 3:4. Everything is offered to us. Nothing is unavailable. So are we satisfied, or do we still want more? Greg Easterbrook, in his book The Progress Paradox, which is subtitled How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse, proves that we have more of almost everything today, except happiness. In fact, the more we have, the unhappier we are, because we know we will never be able to get all the new things that we want. PTW, P. 51. It is not wrong to enjoy the physical blessings God provides or engage in lawful material pursuits, but these must not become the focus of our lives. Moreover, we must live life to God's glory, not our own. The Holman commentary quoted above offers sage counsel from Renaissance author Thomas A. Kempis. Let temporal things be used, but things eternal desired. You cannot be satisfied with any temporal good, because you are not created to enjoy these alone. Although you should possess all created good, yet you could not be happy therewith nor blessed, but in God, who created all things, consists your whole blessedness. We must have the right foundation and parameters, trusting in God's promises. Indeed, as the Preaching the Word commentary points out, if we were able to find lasting satisfaction in earthly pleasure, then we would never recognize our need for God. But satisfaction does not come in the pleasures themselves. It comes separately. Satisfaction only comes in God Himself, so that our dissatisfaction may teach us to turn to Him. God is not a spoilsport. He is not trying to take pleasure away from us but to give it to us. Once we learn how to find our satisfaction in God Himself, then all His other gifts become the best and truest pleasures. P. 52, 54. In Ecclesiastes 1:17, Solomon said, I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. Now, at the beginning of the last subsection of the first major section, he says, I turned my heart to consider wisdom and madness and folly, Ecclesiastes 2:12, literally, to see or behold these, Green's literal translation. In this latter case, he is reflecting on what his search has revealed. The second part of verse 12 seems to mean that no one is going to come along with some great new investigation of the matter that might overturn Solomon's conclusions, for he has seen and done it all. So what has Solomon come to see? First, that wisdom is better, or more profitable, than folly, verse 13. A wise man can see where he's going and what he's doing, making sense of life choices, while the thoughtless fool can't figure anything out, suffering more because of it, see verse 14. A thinking person can see that certain ways of living have advantages over others. It's better to tell the truth than get caught up in lies, and it's better to work hard than to be lazy. Would anyone doubt that? It's better to be faithful to your mate than to bring catastrophe to your home. So it's best in life to live wisely and morally. Tommy Nelson, A Life Well Lived, p. 33. Thus there is in wisdom a certain profit, as sought at the book's outset, Ecclesiastes 1:3. Second, however, wisdom is limited. It will not shield us from what is inevitable for everyone. Death, the great equalizer. Sooner or later everyone comes to the same shocking realization. One day I am going to die, my heart will beat one last time, my lungs will exhale one final breath, and that will be the end of my days on this earth. Preaching the word commentary, Ryken, p. 63. Whether wise or fool, all will die and, as time passes, be forgotten, verses 14-16, compare Ecclesiastes 1:11. The Holman Old Testament commentary notes, if it is true that death will overtake both the fool and the wise, what is the point of trying so hard to be good? This question occurs to many good people who quit trying to be good and decide to go wild by engaging in reckless and destructive behavior. Others pride themselves on continuing to be good and conclude erroneously that dependence on God is not necessary, or they hold to it only superficially. The reality of death arrests both these types of good people from thinking that their own efforts will bring them lasting fulfillment apart from God and His redemption. More, note on Ecclesiastes 2:15. With the stark awareness that his grand quest for wisdom was, just as the waywardness of fools, vanity and grasping for the wind, Solomon came to hate this life. It was distressing to him, for there was no escaping this realization, verse 17. And what of his great accomplishments and acquisitions? He came to hate these too because it all seemed pointless. Death would force him to pass these on to others. Verse 18. Solomon finds no satisfaction in bequeathing a legacy, for there is no way of knowing whether the legacy, intended to carry on the memory of his great deeds, will be perpetuated or squandered. Verse 19. But more fundamentally, he finds it frustrating that a person who works so hard for something cannot continue enjoying it but must pass it on to others who have not worked for it at all. Verse 21. Not only did Solomon's impressive intellect, vast wealth and great works not lead him to happiness, they actually led him to despair. Verse 20. To days of sorrow and fretful nights. Verse 23. Solomon's description of sinking into hopelessness and depression pulls the reader down with him. In verse 22 he essentially repeats his opening question of Ecclesiastes 1:3, what gain is there for all man's efforts under the sun? All seems so utterly pointless. Only now, at this lowest, bleakest point, is he ready to begin presenting the solution to this dark and seemingly unsolvable dilemma? Having sunk to the depths of despair, a light at last dawned in Solomon's thinking in this conclusion to the book's first major section. He had been striving of his own accord to essentially force meaning and happiness from life. But it does not work that way. Rather, Solomon at last comes to see that we must embrace the enjoyment in everyday life, realizing that it is from the hand of God. Verse 24. This includes the labor that Solomon had come to despise. Some imagine that in the paradise of Eden, Adam and Eve strolled about with nothing to do. But God gave them the major work of subduing the earth and tending the vast garden. Genesis 1:28, Genesis 2:15. God himself works, and he's given human beings work to do also. Unfortunately, because of Adam's sin, our work has been cursed, which turns our labor into toil and trouble. But there is still a basic goodness about work that comes from our Creator. We were made in the image of a working God, and thus we have the capacity to find his pleasure in work itself, even apart from anything that we gain by working. The way to experience this pleasure is to work for God and not simply for ourselves. Preaching the Word Commentary, Ryken, p. 73, see 1 Corinthians 10:31, Colossians 3:23. The statement in Ecclesiastes 2:24 about eating and drinking and enjoying good in our labor is the first of similar refrains in Ecclesiastes. As mentioned in our introduction to the book, some take these out of context as advocating a life of mere pleasure-seeking. But the proper context reveals a God-centered focus. Indeed, the very fact of accepting good things in life as coming from God implies a life of faith in his providence and abiding care. Moreover, verse 26 makes clear that God's gifts are ultimately intended for those classed as good and not for sinners. We will consider this further momentarily. Before that, let's look at two textual difficulties here, one in verse 24 and one in verse 25. The wording of verse 24 in most versions does not represent the actual Hebrew here. The New King James Version, for instance, has "nothing is better for a man than that he should." The word rendered "better" is tov or tov, which simply means good. This could have the comparative sense of better if paired with a short preposition that would mean than in context. Yet that word is not present. Note that "than" is in italics in the NKJV, indicating it is assumed. Most scholars believe that the word must have originally been part of the Hebrew text but has dropped out at some point, noting that other instances of the refrain in Ecclesiastes 3:12 and Ecclesiastes 8:15 do show a comparison. But, as Dr. Walter Kaiser points out, no evidence supports that assumption, even though the translators of most English versions adopted it. They reason that the point of Koheleth, the preacher, is that nothing is left for mankind but to try calmly to enjoy the present, that the best that man can do is to get some physical pleasure out of life while he can. P. 45. Again, though, that is based on an assumed reading, not the actual one. The structure of the other refrain verses is worth considering but not determinative. After all, the various occurrences of the refrain do not have the same wording anyway, nor do they make exactly the same point. Moreover, the phrase "for a man" in Ecclesiastes 2:24 should actually be "in man," as the preposition here is the Hebrew "be," not "la" as in Ecclesiastes 6:12 and Ecclesiastes 8:15. So, rather than assume missing an altered text in Ecclesiastes 2:24, we should consider whether the wording here makes sense as it is. A more literal rendering would be, "There is nothing good in man that he should eat and drink and cause his soul to see good in his labor." Young's literal translation has, "There is nothing good in a man who eateth, and hath drunk, and hath shown his soul good in his labor." The Holman Old Testament commentary expresses the wording as follows: there is nothing in man to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. Or we could say it this way: there is not a good, inherent, in man, Kaiser, 44-45. This is a powerful statement that we humans can't create anything good on our own. We are dependent on God for any lasting goodness or fulfillment. More, note on Ecclesiastes 2:18-26. Kaiser elaborates, thus we must conclude that even the most mundane and earthly things of life do not lie within man's grasp to donate to himself. The source of all good, contrary to the expectations of most systems of humanism and idealism, cannot be located in man. He doesn't have it, as the saying goes. It is all beyond him. Rather, it must come from God. Man must get accustomed to realizing that if he is to receive satisfaction from his food and drink, that satisfaction, like all satisfaction, will have to come from the hand of God. P. 45. The wording of verse 25 is also disputed. The NKJV has, for who can eat, or who can have enjoyment, more than I? The difficulty here lies in the words more than I? First of all, the Hebrew here, ksmimeni, is generally understood to literally read outside me, apart from me or without me. In context, it seems odd to many that Solomon would be saying, for, who can have enjoyment outside me? That is, he alone or those joined to him. It is conceivable that the meaning is beyond me, thus the more than I in the NKJV, though this would be unusual. If this is the meaning of the verse, then it would seem Solomon is declaring himself the person best suited to analyzing the matter. Secondly, however, most scholars believe the phrase in question should be rendered not without me but without him or apart from him. See, for example, NIV, BBE, referring to God. They point to this rendering in the Greek Septuagint and several medieval Hebrew manuscripts that have mimenu instead of mimeni. The NET Bible notes, the textual deviation is a case of simple orthographic confusion between yod, or yud, and vav, or vav, as frequently happened, note 115 on Ecclesiastes 2, the idea being that a scribe did not extend the vav down far enough so that it looked like a yod. However, scholar Mitchell DeHoot believes that a third-person singular suffix, I, exists in Hebrew, and that, even, without emendation the meaning is without him, PBQ, P, 269, Psalms, Volume 3, 1970, P, 375, Tyndale Old Testament Commentaries, Eaton, footnote on Ecclesiastes 2:25. This translation, saying that we can't have real enjoyment apart from God, seems to best fit the context, especially if the meaning of verse 24 is that man cannot experience true enjoyment of himself. Note also the beginning of verse 26, for God gives. The italics in the NKJV means that the word for God is not actually in the original text here. More precise would be, for he gives. This follows well if God is the subject of verse 25. The proper perspective here is realizing our total dependence on God, not just for gifts to enjoy but the ability to truly enjoy them and be content. The same idea is expressed in the conclusion of the next section of the book, which states that God gives people the power to enjoy what he gives. See Ecclesiastes 5:19. Implied in all this is a relationship with God, which becomes more explicit in Ecclesiastes 2:26. As noted earlier, this verse makes clear that God's gifts are intended for those who are good in his sight. A broader scriptural overview reveals that these are the upright, People who follow God's ways, in line with the directive given at the end of Ecclesiastes. And the whole Bible also reveals that any goodness in man is not his own but is from God. Those who are upright are so because God has redeemed them and empowered them to obey him. If they persist in his ways, he blesses them yet further. It is stated here that he rewards them with wisdom and knowledge and joy. This is different from Solomon's earlier statement about human beings searching out wisdom being a burdensome task given to them by God, Ecclesiastes 1:13. That referred to human learning by experimentation, observation and learning lessons the hard way. In the present statement of Ecclesiastes 2:26, Solomon is referring to the blessing of learning from God as wisdom and truth, including how to live, and how to be happy. Solomon the preacher is advocating the life of faith, which does not understand everything. See CA chapter 3, but looks for the hand of God in the events of daily life. A useful parallel is 1 Timothy 6-6-19, with its reminder that we are to be content with food and clothing, realizing that God gives us richly everything to enjoy. The walk with God means that we can ask for his wisdom to use life rightly and his knowledge to understand such of his ways as he may disclose to us, and thus experience the joy of fulfillment despite life's difficulties. V. 26, CF. Matthew 25:21, Romans 12:2, Hebrews 12:2, James 1:5, James 3:13-18, Expositors, note on Ecclesiastes 2:24-26. Solomon follows in verse 26 with a warning against living contrary to God as a sinner, the first time he addresses this matter, but it becomes an important theme through the rest of the book. This should dispel the notion that the message of the book is that we should cast off moral restraints and hedonistically pursue whatever we want. Unlike that of the righteous, the sinner's burden of trying to find fulfillment in life is unrelieved. Moreover, any apparent success of the wicked is only temporary, as all they gather and collect will ultimately go to the righteous. We see this elsewhere from Solomon in Proverbs 13:22, but the wealth of the sinner is stored up for the righteous. Compare Proverbs 28:8. Job 27:16-17. This is sometimes the outcome in life today. But the ultimate view here is of the future kingdom of God, when all will be set right. Far from a morose vision limited to the inequities of the present, Ecclesiastes in several places looks forward to the time when right will prevail. This, again, is a position of faith, trusting in God's promises of what is to come. It answers the dilemma of leaving one's possessions and achievements to others because of death in Ecclesiastes 2:18-21. The righteous will ultimately be resurrected and inherit all things, far beyond anything they gathered in this life. Some think that the last sentence of Ecclesiastes 2:26, "This also is vanity and grasping for the wind," refers both to God's gifts to the righteous and to the task he has given sinners, as some hopeless comment on the arbitrariness of what God gives people. But there is no arbitrariness here at all. The righteous are rewarded and sinners must relinquish what they have to the righteous. This is not vanity but perfectly just. There is clear value in serving God. The conclusion of vanity and grasping for the wind here refers only to the plight of the wicked. They strive and strive in heaping up acquisitions to themselves but all for naught, as it's ultimately going to someone else. The words "this also" here may be translated "this indeed," for the Hebrew gam may be used for emphasis as well as for addition. Tyndale, note on verse 26. That is, after having called other things vanity and grasping for the wind, Solomon says of the striving of the wicked, "This indeed is vanity and grasping for the wind." End.